where no artist could paint, and My Wild Irish Rose. The music so loud you stopped trying to be heard over it after a while and pointed instead. Pointed at the sword swallower and the fat lady. Pointed at the shooting gallery and Jacob's ladder. Pointed at the horse that could count. The lights, music, and frenzied whirl of strangeness worked magic on the crowd. Normally stoic farmers grinned around penny cigars. Their stone-faced wives tittered like young girls, and their kids gaped goggle-eyed at the spectacle of an honest-to-God African pygmy sitting on the shoulder of the world's tallest cowpoke. Jesse bought popcorn and watched folks ride the pleasure wheel and the roundabout. He blew two bits throwing baseballs, trying to win a vase for Mama, but walking away with only a Chinese finger trap. A barker spieled him into laying down a nickel to see a flicker projected onto the wall of a tent, ghostly footage of a parade in New York City. In another tent, gentlemen only, two sleepy girls danced the hoochie-coochie in peekaboo harem get-ups for most of the male parishioners of the First Baptist Church. Too shy himself to stare openly at the dancers, Jesse pretended to look at the ground, sneakily raising his eyes to watch without lifting his head. He was starting to enjoy the show when a co-worker of his, Wade Finney, sidled up with his tongue hanging out. "The redhead'll suck your pecker for $3, he whispered like someone who knew something. "That so?" Jesse said. The notion of sticking his pecker anywhere Wade's had been held no appeal. He waited until the fool was absorbed in the show again and slipped back out onto the midway. Claudine was standing outside her booth. "You want me to tell your fortune, monsieur?" she called to him, playing up her French accent. Her eyes were rimmed with kohl, her lips painted red. Wild black hair spilled down her back, and silver stars decorated the blue robe she wore, stars that glittered under the torches like the real thing. Right then and there, Jesse's map was redrawn. All roads would lead to her forever after. He sat across from her in her candlelit stall. Sweet smoke curled out of a brass incense burner shaped like a dragon. Claudine gestured at the deck of tarot cards and the crystal ball on the table between them. "What is your question?" she said. "Are you really a gypsy?" Jesse said. "Among other things." "We got an old woman around here who about drowned when she was a girl. She can tell your future by looking in a teacup." "There are many ways to lift the veil." Jesse pointed at the crystal ball. "You can see the future in that." "Those with the gift of prophecy can," Claudine said. Jesse leaned forward to peer into the ball. "It's true," he said. "I see it clear as day. You and me are going to fall madly in love." Claudine told him later that she tried to call a roustabout to bounce him for his sass, but couldn't get her mouth to work right. "You'd already laid me low," she said. A mariachi band approaches the booth where Jesse, Johona, and Edgar are sitting. A man wearing a sombrero and strumming a guitar asks if they'd like to hear anything special. Johona makes a request. "What's this?" Jesse says when the band starts to play. "Paloma Negra," Johona says. "My dad always asks for it." "What's it about?" "Fuck if I know." Johona gives the musicians a dollar when they finish, and they move on to the next table. Edgar is done eating and getting restless. "I want to play more pinball," he says. "We'll get a move on soon," Jesse says. "Hold your horses." "I know something else fun we could do," Johona says. "What?" Edgar says. "It's a surprise," Johona says. "You up for a surprise?" "I guess I am," Edgar says, like he's accepting a challenge. "What about you?" Johona says to Jesse. He feels uneasy, as if he's wandered too far out onto thin ice. At the same time, he's not yet ready to end the night. So he's going to ignore his misgivings and take Johona where she wants to go, spend a while longer courting Claudine's ghost. As they get up to leave, Edgar sings softly, "I've been to Hollywood. I've been to Redwood." "Hey," Johona says. "I know Neil Young," Edgar says. "Jesse don't, but I do." They drive out of town and wind along a narrow road up the side of a mountain. Johona has Jesse take a turnoff that ends at a wide, flat overlook with a view of the city. "Park in the bushes in case the cops cruise by," she says. Jesse pulls into a hollow in a mesquite thicket where the Grand Prix will be hidden from view. He, Johona, and Edgar get out and walk back to the viewpoint. The ground is littered with cigarette butts, crushed beer cans, and McDonald's wrappers. Broken glass glints in the uncannily bright light of a bit of moon blazing overhead. Edgar bends and comes up with an empty shotgun shell. "People party here," Johanna says. She leads the brothers up a short trail to a natural bench on top of a boulder. The three of them sit against the rock, which even now is still warm from the sun. Phoenix sparkles below like diamonds strewn across the desert. The night is perfectly calm, not even a tickle of a breeze. A helicopter hovers silently above downtown, tethered to the earth by the beam of its spotlight. "I can see all the way to Monongah," Edgar says. He tosses a rock, another, another.
"Quit it," Jesse says.
Johanna lights a cigarette. Jesse can smell the bowling alley on her behind the perfume she's wearing.
"Tell me more about Claudine," she says.
"What do you want to know?" Jesse says.
"How long's it been since you two were together?"
They met at the fair in June 1900. Jesse was 24. Claudine looked to be 20 or so, but said she'd been born in 1727 or 28, somewhere in France. She'd once carried a baptism certificate as a reminder, but lost it on one of the many occasions she'd had to run for her life.
"What does it matter now, anyway?" she said.
"A birth date was important to someone plotting a course across time. But since turning, she drifted in eternity, a sea without shores." Johanna blows a smoke ring, waiting for an answer.
"It's been a long time since I last saw her," Jesse says.
"Were you in love?"
"I'd say so."
Every turning is a love story. Love for a woman, a man, a child, for life itself, for darkness and the things found only there. Jesse fell for Claudine the moment he saw her. She fell for him just as quickly. They made love that first night in a bed of tall grass on the bank of Booth's Creek. Jesse had been with other girls, but it was nothing like being with Claudine. She breathed fire into him that raced through his body, burning every dead tree and tumble-down shack, every briar patch and bog inside him. After he came, white-hot, he lay beside her gloriously empty, gloriously free, for the first time in his life. Claudine hurried away before dawn that morning, and the next, and the next. He asked to see her during the day, but she refused. He knew she was hiding something, thought it might be a husband or a child.
"Tell me," he urged her again and again. "Tell me what's wrong."
And on what was supposed to be their last night together, the fair moving on the next day, she finally revealed her secret. They were down by the creek again, but she wouldn't let him touch her this time. Many years earlier, she said, she'd made a choice. In exchange for eternal life and health, she'd infected herself with a sickness, an unholy, incurable sickness, the pain of which was dulled only by drinking the blood of other humans. She and others like her were called rovers. They lived like nomads, keeping constantly on the move in order to avoid detection and surreptitiously stalking victims in the night. Jesse wonders still how she knew he wouldn't raise an alarm or kill her himself after hearing her story, how she sensed the despair and loneliness plaguing him and his intense, near-violent desire to escape the drudgery and hopelessness of Monongah. He wasn't frightened or repulsed when she finished her confession. He was buzzing with strange excitement.
"You've witched me somehow," he said.
"Why?" Claudine replied.
"Because none of what you told me changes how I feel about you."
"If I was a witch, I'd make you disappear," Claudine said. "I'd fix it so I'd never met you." Jesse grabbed her hand and pulled it to his chest.
"I want to come with you," he said.
"You'll have to leave everything behind. Your whole life," Claudine said. "You'll be an outcast. You'll live by new laws."
"Your law," Jesse said. "I'll live by your law."
Claudine turned him that night. He remembers her blood trickling down his throat. The heat of it. The stink of it. He remembers the thunder in his brain and the lightning in his veins as he was destroyed and reborn.
"How long did you go out?" Johanna says.
"Not long," he says.
"Did you break up with her, or did she break up with you?"
More memories come. Memories Jesse doesn't want to revisit.
"Tell me something about you now," he says.
Johanna puffs on her cigarette.
"I've been thinking I'd like being a chef," she says. "Not a cook. A real chef."
"You any good in the kitchen?"
"I burn water, but I could learn. My plan is to go to cooking school somewhere cool like L.A. or New York. Somewhere something's happening. Have you ever been to L.A.?
Lots of times, Jesse says.
Isn't it bitchin'? My old boyfriend and me went once. Venice Beach, Universal Studios. We got stoned with this old hippie and walked all the way down Hollywood Boulevard.
L.A.'s too big for me, Jesse says. I'm a country boy.
I love that it's big. I love that you can get lost there.
Edgar stands and points.
Skunk, he says.
Jehona stands too.
Where?
Down in them bushes.
Jehona squints.
It's too dark, she says.
A mama and a baby.
Can you see them? Jehona says to Jesse. Jesse gets up to look. The disgruntled mutter of powerful engines held in check catches his attention instead. Someone's coming up the road. Headlight beams bounce across the overlook.
Duck, Jehona says. If it's cops, they'll bust us.
Jesse crouches and pulls Edgar down with him. Chapter 10.
I know Mickey Mouse is a cartoon. Him and Minnie and Tom and Jerry. Yogi Bear and Boo Boo. Woody Woodpecker and Fred Flintstone. Popeye, Bluto, Olive Oil, Wimpy, and all them. But the folks that show the cartoons are real. You got Quickfire McIntyre in Birmingham, Uncle Bob in Tucson, Mr. Patches in St. Louis, Happy Herb in Indianapolis, Fred and Fay in Denver, Captain Delta in Stockton, Cactus Vic in Little Rock, and Lorenzo in Tulsa. I know radio and TV come through the air, but the telephone needs a wire. I know everything costs money, plus tax. 10 pennies make a dime, 10 dimes make a dollar, so do 4 quarters. I can pump gas and wash bugs off the windshield. I can drive if there's not too many curves. I bet I can change a tire. If you want to win a fight, kick a man in the balls. It ain't real fighting in the movies. They got bottles that break easy. A king beats a queen beats an ace beats everything. If you shake a pinball machine too hard, you'll tilt it. Stars are cold. So's the moon. Sun's hot. Hotter than hell. It can cook you just like that. Don't drink out of cricks, cause cows shit in them. If your kid has asthma, stick a lock of his hair in a hole in a sourwood tree a little higher up than the kid is tall. When the boy grows taller than the hole, his asthma will be gone. Some people are sad. Some ain't. Jesse's sad. He got sad when Claudine got dusted and stayed that way. Daddy was happy most of the time. Mama was happy. I'm happy. Except when the little devil starts in. He ain't happy, nor sad, nor mean, nor nice. All he is hungry or not hungry. He's nothing but need and teeth and claws. I saved a dog once, and I saved a man. The dog belonged to Mr. Sayer. I was hunting crawdads down by the creek, and I heard some pitiful howling and whining. I first thought to run home, but said to myself, "You ain't yellow," and snuck to the noise, keeping well hid. Mr. Sayer's pup Queenie had one of her paws stuck in a beaver trap. She was crying and thrashing and snapped at me when I come close. I had the idea to use the tow sack I was carrying for the crawdads to cover her muzzle so she couldn't get at me. She took off when I sprung her and run crying all the way back to Mr. Sayer's house. He gave me a dollar coin and a bag of peppermint sucks for setting her free and said she'd have died if I didn't come along. Her leg was broke too bad to fix, but she got around fine on 3. The man I saved was a miner that turned up missing at the end of a shift. A wop named Scalo. The boss man called everybody in to search. Daddy wasn't none too happy about it. Said the bastard's probably drunk in some tavern. He was pulling on his boots, getting ready to go, and I was playing with ants on the porch, drawing a finger across the trail to watch him scatter when a blackness come crashing down on me. Daylight turned dark, and I thought I'd been struck blind, but little by little, like they do when you go from inside to out at night, my eyes started working again. Only I wasn't on the porch no more. I was down in the mine. Daddy took me into the pit when I was a boy. We rode a car down, then got off and walked along a tunnel. We had lanterns, but the light from them didn't do nothing but make the dark darker. Coal dust swirled and water dripped. Daddy told me about black damp and white damp, poison gases. They'll kill you after one whiff, and the deeper we went, the harder it got for me to breathe. Daddy dropped a rock into a shaft and told me to listen for it to hit bottom.
It never did.
I got the notion Daddy was going to toss me down the hole next. This gave me a fright and I run off down the tunnel. I didn't get far before I tripped and my lantern went out and I fainted dead away. Daddy had to carry me back up top. On the porch, I wasn't scared at all. I could see in the dark as good as in day. And what I seen was the Wop. A beam had fallen and trapped his legs. There was his lantern and there was his lunch pail. The lantern had gone out. He banged his pail against the wall and called for help, then lay down and prayed in Italian. When the dark lifted, a figure popped into my head. Number 8, left heading. I run in the house to tell Daddy. I told him I seen the Wop and told him the figure. He grumped and said he ought to whoop me for lying. What is that? Mama asked. Number 8 left heading? It's a drift in the mind, Daddy said. Mama's eyes got big. You gotta take him to tell someone about this, she said. What am I supposed to say, Daddy asked her. My idiot son had a vision? 22 years old and can't shave himself? Can't go to the store without getting lost? That was a lie. I knew the way to the store. And if you don't say something and that man dies, Mama said. They fought on it a while longer till Mama put her foot down. If you don't take him, I will, she said. God damn it, Daddy said, and me and him set off for the mine. Daddy talked to the boss man. He was busy telling crews to search here and search there, and busy telling guards to keep the town folk who came to see the commotion back from the attic. Daddy pulled him aside and said, I'm sorry, and I know it sounds crazy, and the wife, you understand. The boss man looked at me, looked at Daddy, and looked at me again. He had a map of the mine in front of him. Number 8 left heading, he said, tracing it with a finger. That section's been closed for a year. Still, he sent a crew to check. They found the door to the tunnel ajar and the Wop pinned by a fallen timber where he snuck in to take a nap. I saved him, but I couldn't save Daddy. A year later, the mine exploded when he was down there with 300 others. They went looking for survivors, and Mama begged me to try again to see into the darkness. Nothing came to me, hard as I thought. They brought Daddy's body up 4 days later. What was left of it? Barely enough to bury, Mama said. I know proper is a coffin. I know proper is a stone and flowers. The folks we kill don't get none of that, except for sometimes a prayer. I know one or two good ones.
Chapter 11. June 27th, 1976, 3 p.m. After a few hours' rest, I feel strong enough to finish setting down the events of the past day. It's more important than ever there's some kind of record now that things have turned strange. After Czarnecki showed me the boy chained in the shed, we returned to the cabin. The old man poured himself a tumbler of bourbon, and we sat at the little table. What's wrong with him? I asked. They call themselves rovers, he said. I think they're some kind of vampires. Come on, I said. It's not what you're picturing. All that pointy teeth and turning into a bat Dracula bullshit. They're predators. Pure and simple. They stalk humans, cut their throats, and drink their blood. One of them killed my wife, and one killed your son. I'd have thought the old man was insane if not for what I'd just witnessed. Sunlight opened wounds on the kid's flesh, and those wounds healed instantly in the dark. In any other context, you'd call that a miracle. I used the kid as a pointer, Czarnecki said. A what? I said. These things look like just another person to you or me, but they recognize each other, give off some kind of glow only they can see. So I used the kid to sniff them out. It's something Mr. Otto taught me. The kid finds rovers and I kill them. Mr. Otto again. I asked who he was. Mr. Otto ran a feed lot in Omaha, Czarnecki said. His daughter, Iris, disappeared one day in, I believe it was 1922, and turned up later drained of blood. The police couldn't come up with any suspects, and after a while they stopped looking. Mr. Otto started searching on his own, determined to find whoever killed Iris.
What he eventually uncovered was something almost beyond his ken.
Vampires, I said mockingly.
Call them that. Call them rovers, call them whatever you want, Czarnecki said. But they do exist. Bloodthirsty creatures that prey on humans. Once Mr. Otto discovered them, he set out to destroy as many as he could. It was a crusade, good against evil. And he'd been at it 30 years when he visited me in Carson City and showed me this.
Czarnecki reached under his shirt for a gold ring hanging on a chain around his neck.
This belonged to Marjorie, he said. One of the monsters Mr. Otto killed was wearing it. Her name and mine are engraved inside. And that's how he tracked me down. I was skeptical, as I said before. I even thought he might have killed Marjorie himself. But then he took me on a hunt, and I pretty damn quick became a believer.
Czarnecki paused to catch his breath. I noticed how his hands shook when he lifted his glass, how dull his eye was. He's sick, I thought. He's coming to the end of his time.
Mr. Otto was 60 then, he continued. He was looking for someone to take over for him. We hunted together until he passed away, and I kept going on my own. I knew I'd never get the fucker that murdered Marjorie, but there were plenty more to send to hell. My aim was to wipe out every bloodsucker on the planet. I didn't get there. But maybe you will.
Me? I said. Not me.
What was your son's name?
Czarnecki said. Leave him out of this, I said.
Benny,
Czarnecki said.
You hear Benny calling to you, don't you? You hear him begging for revenge.
I don't hear anything except the nonsense of a crazy old drunk, I said. The stuffed head of a bear snarled at me from above the fireplace, and the wooden floor quaked beneath my chair. My hands were balled into sweaty fists as I stood and hurried for the door. I felt like I was walking with someone else's feet.
I'm going hunting tonight,
Czarnecki said.
If you want more proof what I've told you is true, come along.
I left the cabin without another word and locked myself in the Econoline. Then I sat there for hours, mind racing. I sat there until the sun went down and the air grew chill. I sat there until night blacked the trees and a light came on in the cabin. I sat there until Czarnecki called out,
"There's an extra can of stew if you want it."
When I returned to the cabin, the old man put a bowl in front of me and didn't say anything until I'd eaten my fill. Then all he asked was,
"You ready?"
I answered with a nod. I followed him out to the shed, him carrying a bowl of Dinty Moore for the kid. The boy was sitting on the cot in the dark, the blanket draped over his bare shoulders. The only other thing in the shed was a reeking 5-gallon bucket that served as a toilet. Czarnecki slid the bowl and a spoon across the floor. The kid snatched them up and shoveled stew into his mouth. When he finished, Czarnecki threw him a ring of keys.
"Get dressed," he said.
"I need more than that slop," the kid said. "It's been over a month since I fed proper." Czarnecki drew a pistol, a .45 from the pocket of his coveralls, and pointed it at the boy.
"Get dressed," he said again.
The kid unlocked the shackles on his ankles and pulled on a pair of jeans that lay neatly folded on the floor, then sat on the cot to tie his sneakers. He reshackled his ankles, took off his handcuffs, and donned a t-shirt and a denim jacket. When the cuffs were back in place, Czarnecki ordered him to undo the chain from the eye bolt in the floor and return the keys.
"Stand clear," the old man said, waving the .45 at me. "Never let him get too close. They're no stronger than us, but because they can heal, they'll take chances you wouldn't and fight a lot harder. If this one tried to jump me, I shoot him in the head. The round wouldn't kill him, but it'd put him down long enough for me to finish him off. And there are a few ways to do that. I could stop his heart with a knife and leave him to rot. I could drag him into the sun. I could burn him, or I could starve him of blood. The quickest and easiest way is to hurt them enough they can't fight back, then cut off their heads. They'll turn to dust in an instant.
The kid emptied the slop bucket in the bushes, then carried it to the truck and put it inside the camper bolted to its bed. He was so skinny, he had to hold his pants up when he walked. Czarnecki kept the gun on him until he had climbed in on the passenger side of the cab and secured himself to an eye bolt on the floor. We slid in on either side of him, Czarnecki behind the wheel. I leaned against the door, nervous at being so close to the kid. He stunk, and the whites of his eyes were pus yellow and shot through with veins. "So who are you?" he asked me. "Nobody," I replied. "Nice to meet you, nobody. I'm nobody, too."
"Leave the man alone," Czarnecki said.
"Yes, sir," the kid said, meaning, "fuck you." Czarnecki turned on the radio. A sportscaster was cracking jokes about Ali's fight with that Japanese wrestler. A Bicentennial Minute came on, the story of a Revolutionary War battle fought on this very day exactly 200 years ago. "Don't let me die listening to this," the kid groaned. "Put on some music." Czarnecki dialed in a country and western station and played that the rest of the way to Reno. It was all noise to me. Between my fear of the kid and bracing myself as the old man raced down the mountain, I couldn't hold a thought in my head. I finally took to reading road signs to have something to focus on. When we got into town, the kid started looking for rovers. We cruised the streets for hours, from one end of Reno to the other, past the casinos, past the tourist motels, past the flop houses and dives. Every time we spotted a bum blowing his nose or a hooker preening on the corner, Czarnecki would bark, "How about that one?" And the kid's reply was always the same, "Nope." Czarnecki grew frustrated.
"If you don't earn your keep, you're not worth keeping," he said.
"I'm all messed up," the kid said. "I need to feed."
"You know the deal. Find me a monster first."
"I can't see straight.
Find me a monster."
The kid's chains rattled as he slumped, dejected. We made our third pass down Virginia. I asked Czarnecki if they found rovers every time they went looking.
"I used to get a couple a month," he said. "Places like Reno draw them. Lots of trash for them to feed on. Things have slowed down the last few years, though. I don't know why. We've been out 15 times in the past 60 days and had no luck. Sometimes I think this asshole is gold bricking."
He slapped the kid on the back of the head.
"Are you slow playing me, boy?"
The kid didn't reply, just kept staring out the cracked windshield. Czarnecki slapped him again and said,
"Better not be."
Around 2 a.m., as we were crawling through a stucco and cinder block barrio, the kid leaned forward so suddenly I threw my arms up to protect myself. "There," he said. He pointed to a Mexican wearing a black cowboy hat and ostrich skin boots. The man's unsteady gait showed he was drunk. He nearly toppled over, stepping off the curb to cross the street.
"Get out and tail him," Czarnecki said to me.
"What?" I replied.
"I'll circle the block so he doesn't get wise."
Caught up in the moment, I hopped out of the truck and fell in behind the man, keeping a careful distance. Czarnecki drove past and disappeared around the next corner. The street was deserted. All the stores shut up behind steel gates. The only place still open was a beer bar with a cracked plastic sign, Club Tango. Mexican music umpapad from behind a heavy curtain drawn across the doorway. The man I was following paused out front, stood there swaying like a palm tree in the wind, then suddenly continued on his way. stumbling as if an unseen hand had shoved him. The lights of a passing bus pinned his shadow to a brick wall, his hat enormous. A couple of blocks later, he came to a two-story fleabag motel fronting a parking lot full of dusty, dented cars and trucks. After a few fumbling stabs with a key, he let himself into a ground floor room. I turned to look for Czarnecki's pickup. Parked down the street, the old man flashed his headlights.
"What room?"
he said when I rejoined him and the kid. "8," I said.
"Ha,"
he said, as if addressing the Mexican.
"Gotcha, you son of a bitch."
"What happens now?" I said.
"We wait,"
Czarnecki said. "How long?"
"Till daybreak. They're weaker then."
I could have ended the hunt at that instant, forced the old man to take me back to his place, gotten into the Econoline, and put this madness behind me. I could have, but I didn't. You see, baby, Czarnecki was right. I do hear Benny demanding vengeance. I've heard it every day since learning of his death. And to have shied away from a possible lead to his killer because of my own fear would have been another betrayal of him and made me even more of a failure as a father than I've already been. So, Czarnecki got out of the truck. I stood behind him as he drew his .45 and threw the kid the keys. The kid freed himself from the bolt on the floor, slid out of the cab, and walked back to the camper. Czarnecki opened the door. Inside was a plywood crate resembling a crude coffin. The kid climbed into the camper, opened the hinged lid of the crate, and lay down inside. Czarnecki closed the lid and secured it with 3 padlocks. He covered the crate with a canvas tarp. Winded by even this bit of exertion, he sat at the camper's small table to catch his breath.
"You stick him in here if you're going to be out during the day," he said, patting the crate. "Keeps him out of the sun."
We returned to the cab, and Czarnecki moved the truck so we had a clear view of the Mexican's room. The motel had quieted for the night. There were no lights anywhere, except for the flicker of a TV in the office. Czarnecki lit a cigarette, blew the smoke out his window. He asked if I'd been in the military. "The Army," I said, "from 51 to 55.
"So you're used to blood and guts."
"I was a clerk, a typist."
"What do you do for a living now?"
I laughed. For the first time in a long time, I laughed. "I teach typing," I said. "I've come far."
"You must be fast," Czarnecki said.
122 words a minute. The old man whistled, pretending to be impressed.
"I was in the Army too," he said. "Enlisted at 18 and stayed in until I was 30.
"Long haul," I said. He shrugged.
"The pay was decent, and I learned a trade. I was a mechanic after I got out, before Mr. Otto came along."
"Did you like that kind of work?" I asked.
"It made sense," he said. "This part does this, that part does that. You figure out what's not working, replace it, and you're back in business."
He slipped 2 fingers under his eye patch and scratched, while staring with his good eye at what we could see of the night sky through the windshield.
"Do you know the constellations?" he said.
"I knew some when I was a kid," I replied. He pointed.
"There's Hercules. His arms, his legs, his club. Scorpius, the scorpion. Cygnus, the swan. Those 4 in a square there, with the bright one on top. That's Lyra, the lyre."
"Well, well," I said, impressed. Czarnecki tossed his cigarette out the window and opened his door.
"I'm going to grab a couple of hours of shut-eye," he said. "There's another bed in back if you want to sleep too."
There was no way I was going to be able to sleep, especially not lying 5 feet from the kid, no matter how many locks were on the crate. I told Czarnecki I'd stay up front, keep watch. He gave me a mocking salute and said,
"Blow reveille at sunrise if I'm not up already."
The truck trembled and squeaked as he climbed inside the camper and settled down. I made myself as comfortable as I could and tried not to think too much about what morning would bring. The door to the Mexican's room was painted brown, the number white. Below the number was a silhouette of a covered wagon. Sometime around 4, a girl emerged from one of the other rooms, a big girl wearing pajamas and pink slippers. She walked to the payphone in front of the motel and dialed the operator. Slouched in the soul-bleaching fluorescent bubble of the booth, she looked like a criminal or a victim. She told the operator she wanted to make a collect call and pressed her forehead to the glass wall, listening to the rings, waiting for someone to answer. "Mom," she said when someone finally did, "I'm married," and started to weep. Czarnecki woke me by banging on the window. I'd nodded off somewhere near dawn, slid into a half dream of running, falling, and running again. I was relieved to be startled out of it, but as soon as I remembered where I was, I wished I'd come to a million miles away. The sun was rising over the scarred foothills to the east. A few wispy clouds blushed pink. All the decisions I'd made the day before seemed like bad ones, and I was full of dread. I climbed out of the truck and stomped away the stiffness in my legs. I needed coffee. I needed aspirin. I needed a way out. Czarnecki hawked and spit and lit his third cigarette of the morning. One foot dragged a bit as he walked up and set a duffel bag on the hood.
"Let's get to it before everyone's up and about," he said.
I didn't ask any questions. It was too late for that. The match had been struck. The lake of gasoline shimmered beneath it. I followed Czarnecki across the parking lot to the Mexican's room. He unzipped the duffel and took out a crowbar. I felt like I had a sponge stuck in my throat. 30 years fell off the old man as he turned and gave me a wink. He wedged the hooked end of the bar into the crack between the door and the jamb. The flimsy lock broke with one tug, and the door swung open to reveal the Mexican lying on a bed in his underwear. He started to sit up, but Czarnecki was on him in a flash. He pushed him back onto the mattress and plunged an ice pick into his chest, and he died without a sound. Czarnecki struggled to his feet, a sick old man once again.
"I like to use a pick," he said. "Less blood."
He took a few deep, wheezy breaths, then said,
"Come here."
I obeyed like someone hypnotized, stepped into the room and closed the door. Czarnecki grabbed the man's legs and ordered me to help move the body into the bathroom. I took hold of the Mexican under his arms, and we lifted him off the bed. After we'd laid him in the tub, Czarnecki got a hacksaw from his bag of tricks and held it out to me.
"Cut off his head," he said.
I finally found my voice. "No."
"You're here for proof. What I've told you is true," he said. "Cut off his head, and you'll have it."
I'd already crossed the line. If I left at that moment, the only thing I'd know for certain was that I was an accessory to murder. My sole hope of redemption was that the old man was telling the truth about the Rovers, and one way to verify that was to do what he'd ordered. Beating back fear and revulsion, I grabbed the saw and bent over the tub. I pressed the blade against the neck of the corpse, closed my eyes, and went to work. The sound of the saw's teeth chewing through flesh and bone brought bile gushing into my mouth. I peeked through slitted lids to check my progress, caught a flash of bloody muscle and tendon, and nearly fainted. The moment I was sure I couldn't continue, the head came loose. I dropped it, backed away, and forced my eyes open in time to see both the head and body collapse into dust. One instant they were there, and the next nothing was left of the Mexican but his underwear and a mound of feathery gray ash. Czarnecki's monsters were real. While I grappled with the enormity of this, the old man turned on the water and washed the ashes down the drain, using the dead man's skivvies to wipe the tub clean. I didn't react when he said, "Let's go," so he grabbed me by the arm, and we hurried to the truck and made our getaway along empty early morning streets. We left the kid in the camper when we got back here to the cabin. The old man will return him to the shed after dark. I've spent the day in the van trying to sort things out. Right now, I'm lying in the warm glow of a golden afternoon, but I'm chilled to the bone by what I've seen and what I've done. I've been searching for the truth about what happened to Benny, and I believe I found it. I have no proof it was a rover that killed him, no hard evidence like Czarnecki's ring, but I'm almost sure that's how he met his end. There's no happiness in this certainty, but there's the satisfaction of having solved the mystery, which is at least something after so much disappointment and frustration. But a storm still roils within me, because now I have to make a choice. Do I join Czarnecki in his war against the rovers, even though the chances of encountering the one that murdered Benny are slim? Or do I return to you and step back into my old life, knowing that the monsters that murdered our boy and God knows how many others are out there continuing to kill? Truthfully, I feel whichever road I choose is going to lead to my destruction. And all I can do this evening is pray that you, at least, are at peace. Today's passage. Stand in awe and sin not. Commune with your own heart upon your bed and be still. Psalm chapter 4, verse 4.
Chapter 12. Antonia and Elijah meet George Moore's man at a diner. "I'll be the ugliest son of a bitch in the joint," he said when Antonia asked how they'd know him, and he wasn't lying. He looks like a possum with acne scars and a greasy pompadour, as the beadiest black eyes Antonia's ever seen. The waitress is refilling his coffee when the two fiends walk up to his table. He motions for them to sit and proceeds to stir half the sugar in the dispenser into his cup. "Nice bikes," he says, nodding at the Harleys parked out front. "Do you ride?" Elijah asks. "Not me," the possum says. "If I fell off and cracked my skull, I'd be washing my brains off the road with a fire hose. You're good as new in 5 minutes." His grin reveals a mouthful of crooked brown teeth. "Do you have the pictures?" Antonia reaches into the pocket of her denim vest and brings out the Polaroids Bob One took of McMullen, tosses them on the table. The possum squints at the one of the tattoo. "Mors tua vita mia," he says. "Your death, my life," Antonia says. The possum's lips purse like he's tasting something sour. "That about sums up you rovers, doesn't it?" he says. "And you're somehow better," Antonia says. "At least I'm still as God made me." "God," Antonia says. "You fucking child." "I dig blondes, but why's your hair so short?" the possum says. "You trying to look like a man?" Antonia slaps her hand on the table, smirking when the possum jumps. "We'll have what you owe us," Elijah says. The possum sets a paper bag on the table. Elijah picks it up and glances at the stack of bills inside. "And the other?" he says. "Meet me out back," the possum says. He downs his coffee and gets up to pay at the register. Antonio and Elijah walk outside. The diner's neon sign puts on its show, flashing pink, truck, flashing green, town, flashing red, cafe. A semi pulls into the gas station next door and stops, brakes hissing at a diesel pump. A uniformed attendant runs out and shouts, "Good evening, sir. How can I help you?" "If you could go anywhere, where would you go?" Antonia asks Elijah. "Wherever you were," Elijah says. "What if I was in Japan?" "I'd go to Japan." "Italy?" "Italy." "Atlanta." "Don't make me go to Atlanta." The possum comes out and says, "Follow me." Antonio and Elijah start their Sportsters and ride around behind the restaurant. A bright orange light burns at the top of a pole, but the possum's Lincoln is parked away from it, deep in the shadows. He reaches the car as the fiends pull up beside it. The car's dome light goes on when he opens the door. He grabs a cloth drawstring sack from behind the front seat and passes it to Elijah like it's got something that stinks in it. Elijah looks inside. The baby is lying at the bottom. Elijah can't tell if she's dead or alive until he pokes her with a finger and she opens one eye. The possum pulls out another bag, this one from Safeway.
There's formula in here, Pampers, he says.
Antonia takes this bag, though she's thinking the kid won't be around long enough to need what's in it. The possum slides into the Lincoln and drives across the parking lot to the frontage road. Beyond that, cars and trucks zoom past on the freeway, bound for better places. Elijah opens one of his Harley saddlebags and lowers the sack containing the baby into it. Think it'll be okay in here, he says to Antonia.
Why are you asking me? She says. I don't know anything about babies.
That's not true. Elijah knows she had two children before she turned, both of which died of the pox. In all the years they've been together, she's never told him more than that, not even their names. But he can tell she's thinking of them now as she pulls on her gloves. He wishes he could say, it wasn't your fault. Those babies were taken from you by nature, not because you were a bad mother. But they aren't that way with each other. Instead, he says, I hope they haven't burned down the motel while we've been gone. Antonia listens to the traffic on the freeway, which sounds tonight like wind blowing through trees.
Are we really stuck riding herd on these shitheads forever? She says.
We can do whatever you want, Elijah says.
Let's feed on the baby ourselves and take off, she says. Let's go to Japan. Let's go to Italy.
Elijah knows she's just talking. They've never been as safe as they've been since they joined with the others. Never been as powerful. In addition, the only human thing the rest of the fiends have left is their pride, and they'd never forgive an insult to it. If he and Antonia swiped the baby and ran out on them, they'd have six wild animals on their tails. Animals that wouldn't rest until they tracked them down and exacted revenge. Elijah's not ready to die yet, and he's pretty sure Antonia isn't either, but he's still trying to come up with a response when she says,
Gotcha.
What do you mean? He says.
That was a test. Did I pass? I'm not telling.
However she wants to wriggle out of it is fine with Elijah. She stomps her Harley to life, pops it into gear, and roars off. Elijah follows right behind her. Bob 1 and Bob 2 are by the pool when they get back to the motel. The rest of the fiends are playing cards in Pedro and Johnny Kickapoo's room. There's been tension between the Bobs and the others since the Bobs won the right to make the hit and claim the infant. In the hours since they returned from the killing, Yuma has refused to give them enough weed for a joint, and Bob 2 and Johnny almost came to blows because Johnny didn't laugh at one of Bob's jokes. Elijah suggests they pay the Bobs off separately from the others, but Antonia says no, they're adults, and they're going to act like it. She calls a meeting in her and Elijah's room. Everybody files in looking glum, except the Bobs. The baby is lying on the bed. She's been crying since Elijah took her out of the sack.
Did you check its diaper?
Yuma asks. She was a nanny in another life, looked after the children of the richest man in Cincinnati.
I just changed it, Elijah says. Then it's probably hungry.
Elijah hands her the bag containing formula and diapers.
This came with it, he says. Any of you fuckers know how to mix formula?
Yuma says.
Just give it a tit, Bob 2 says, trying to be funny.
Grumbling, Yuma sets about preparing a bottle. Antonia brings out Moore's original $25,000 and sets it on the table next to the $25 she and Elijah got from the possum. Minus Beaumont's 10%, everyone but the Bobs will receive $7,500. Johnny and Real Deal do the divvying, licking their fingers and dealing the bills into six stacks. Yuma finishes shaking the formula. She picks up the baby and sticks the nipple of the bottle in her mouth. The kid stops crying and starts sucking.
Enjoy your last meal, Bob 2 says. You ever had a child?
Yuma asks him.
Depends how you mean. You're a sick fuck.
The sickest, Bob 2 says. He pulls a big hunting knife from his belt.
How about I nick the brat right now and make you sore losers watch us drink?
Real Deal draws his knife.
How about I cut you in half, he says.
Bob 2 glances at Bob 1, who, with a tiny shake of his head, tells him to back down. Bob 2 twirls his knife like a gunslinger playing with his pistol before returning it to its sheath. He leans against the wall and crosses his arms over his chest. Real Deal puts his blade away, too. We need to take a vote, Antonia says, looking to ease the tension. We're pulling out of here tomorrow night. All in favor of New Orleans as our next stop, say aye. A chorus of ayes rings out. It's unanimous, as Antonia knew it would be. New Orleans it is, then, she says. Now, who's next to feed? They've worked things out so their feedings are staggered, thereby leaving a narrower wake of dead and disappeared behind them. Pedro raises his hand. I'm up. Seems like it's been a while. 45 days. But I can't go much longer. I'm getting itchy. We'll find something along the way. Set you right. Johnny gestures at the piles of bills on the table in front of him. Come and get it, he says. Pedro, Antonia, and Elijah grab their stacks. Real Deal pockets his. Snag mine, doll, Yuma says to him. She's still feeding the baby. Go on, Bob One says to Yuma. I'll take the nipper. Yuma hesitates, primal reflex tightening her grip on the child, but she quickly overrides it. Bob One rests the kid in the crook of his arm and tosses the bottle away. He picks up the drawstring sack and slips the infant back inside. Feed somewhere else, Antonia says. We've got a good place, Bob Two says. And bury it deep when you're done. The Bobs put the sack in one of Bob Two's saddlebags and blast off. They take Central South. Bright and bustling downtown gives way to dark warehouses and auto body shops, which give way to brand new tracts of homes bounded by freshly planted palm trees. Out past these, they ride across the desert until the road narrows and climbs a mountain. Near the top, they turn onto a dirt road that leads to a spot overlooking the city. They've been here before, to drink beer and get stoned. Teenagers use it as a lover's lane, but tonight they have it to themselves. They park at the edge of the flat and dismount. Bob Two takes the sack out of his saddlebag. The ruins of an old adobe cabin sit on a ledge 50 feet downslope from the overlook. The fiends sidestep along the steep, slippery trail leading to it. Rocks and dirt loosed by their passage cascade down the mountain. Bob Two trips, and the jolt startles the baby. She lets out a yell Bob swears will be heard all the way back in town. Shut it up, Bob One says. You know of a magic word, Bob Two says. Try singing. I'll try stomping its brains out if it doesn't stop soon, Bob Two says. He cradles and rocks the sack, quieting the kid to a fuss. The fiends enter the cabin by ducking under a low doorway. The roof has collapsed and the floor is littered with rubble. The walls still standing are spattered with graffiti. A pentagram, a skull and crossbones, a broken heart. Bob Two sets the sack down, and he and Bob One step through a breach in the north wall to where there's an old rock garden. Bob One pulls out a pint of Seagram's, has a sip, and passes it to Bob Two. The men catch their breaths while contemplating the lights of Phoenix. I remember this town when there were still horses on the streets, Bob One says. You are as old as dinosaur shit, Bob Two says. Don't I know it? I see 22 in the mirror, but I feel 122. It's all in your mind. I'm not so sure. Years have weight. Look at Elijah, born in 17-something and still going strong. Maybe it's the pace I'm living at, always on the run. Bob Two nods toward the cabin, toward the baby. Wait till you suck on that, he says. You'll be raring to go again. I've been thinking, Bob One says. Uh-oh. I want the kid to myself. I want a whole year where I don't have to hunt, not just 6 months. To do what? I'm going to go to Cuba and find the girl who turned me. Bob Two is shocked by this, hurt even. Are you serious? He says. I need a purpose. You need not to complicate things. Maybe so, but I want to go to Cuba. And what about me? Bob Two says. That bitch left you high and dry, but I've been loyal for 25 years. Never once let you down. Always had your back. You're a good dude, for sure. The best. But fuck me anyway, right? Bob One looks away, uncomfortable. Well, I'm not just giving the kid up to you, Bob Two continues. I made the hit and earned the right to feed, too. I know that, Bob One says. And that's why I'm willing to gamble for it. Double or nothing. Gamble, how? Liar's poker, Rochambeau. We can flip a coin if you want. The baby cries again, a reminder to the Bobs that every minute they draw this out is one more when trouble might find them. An idea comes to Bob Two, one that'll put Bob One's resolve to the test. He draws the snub-nosed 38 he carries. "The game's Russian roulette," he says. "Jesus," Bob One says. "It's that or let's get to feeding." "You don't think I'm serious, do you?" "Prove it." Bob One stands there chewing his beard. He's played Russian roulette a few times before, wagering with other rovers. He won twice and lost once. Took a bullet to the brain. The pain was excruciating, and he's always wondered if he's not a little dumber now than before. But he's determined to see Maria again and get answers to the questions that have tormented him for half a century. "Roulette it is, then," he says. Bob, too, is nervous. He only suggested the game thinking the other Bob would back down. With trembling hands, he opens the cylinder of the revolver and drops the cartridges into his palm. Retrieving one, he slides it back into an empty chamber, closes the cylinder, and spins it. "Who's first?" he says. Bob One takes the gun from him. Might as well get it over with. He presses the muzzle to his temple and pulls the trigger. Relief weakens his knees, but he keeps a blank face as he spins the cylinder and passes the gun to Bob Two. "God damn it," Bob Two says. He swipes at the fear sweat dripping off his nose. "God damn it." He puts the gun to his head. "God damn it. Ha!" He spins the cylinder and thrusts the gun at Bob One, who moves a little slower this time, who takes a deep breath and twists the tension out of his neck before raising the pistol. The echo of the shot caroms and fades. Bob One crumples to the ground, blood spurting from a hole in his head. Bob Two picks up the Seagrams and guzzles what's left. He won, but he's still angry at the other Bob for ruining their partnership. Even if they keep riding together, things will never be the same. The baby stopped crying when the gun went off, but bawls again now. Fuck it, it'll be quiet forever soon enough. Bob One's foot twitches. His mind restarts in stages, like lights going on floor by floor in a skyscraper. He sits up with a groan and touches the crater where the bullet exited his skull, flesh and bone regenerating even as he does so. "You lose, motherfucker," are the first words he hears when his ears stop ringing. "Yeah, yeah," he replies, relieved to find his tongue works. The baby is still crying, but softly now. Bob Two draws his knife. "To the victor go the spoils," he says, and enters the cabin. A second later, he shouts, "Where's the kid?" "What do you mean?" Bob One says. "The kid, it's..." Bob Two checks the floor of the cabin again. "Where the fuck is it?"
Chapter 13.
Two motorcycles circle the overlook and stop at the brink. Jesse worms on his belly for a clear view. The bike's engines cough and die, and two bearded men, one tall, one short, step off the Harleys. Jesse's heart freezes. Rovers. There's a patch on the back of their jackets, a grinning skull with goat horns. A banner above it proclaims, "Fiends," another below, "Hell." Jesse's heard stories about the fiends, rovers who travel in a pack, killing anyone, turned or unturned, who crosses them. Bad news all around. Johanna creeps over to lie beside him. "Biker trash," she says. The shorter fiend takes a sack out of a saddlebag on his bike, and he and the other start down a path that ends at the bones of a cabin on a ledge below the outlook. Jesse can just make out the crumbling structure from where he and Johanna are hiding. Edgar, back at the boulder they were sitting on, stands to look at the bikers, too.
"Rovers,"
he says.
"Get down,"
Jesse whispers. It'd be too risky to try to sneak back to where the car is hidden. Better to lie low and wait until the fiends leave.
"We'll sit tight,"
Jesse begins, but is interrupted by the piercing cry of an infant in distress. The fiends halt on the trail. There's a baby in the sack they're carrying. They discuss how to quiet it. And when one threatens to stomp it, Johanna gasps. The infant settles, and the bikers continue their descent. Johanna asks what they're doing with a baby. Jesse says he doesn't know,